Liveline on RTE Radio 1 with Kia. Going electric? Go really electric with an EV or plug-in hybrid from the Kia e-range.
Kia. Movement that inspires.
1850-715-815.
Hello, good afternoon, and you're very welcome to Liveline. And Joe at RTE.ie is the number. There have been a number of events, some of them covered here on Liveline beginning on Monday. Obviously, the attacks and the abuse of students at the hands of Father Joseph Marmion, and also the horrific attack, unprovoked attack on Seamus Troy. Seamus had contacted us on Friday. He wants to raise the issue of the absence of counselling afterwards and the fact that he didn't have his say in court against this man who was really, really affected his life in such a horrific way. People, he broke. Seamus was just out of hospital after an operation, was heading to get the provincial bus home, and this man out of the blue attacked him and broke Seamus's crutch on his head. That prompted Mary Lynch to contact us, and we'll talk to Mary in a second. In the meantime, as Mary was reminding us today, events over the last 24 hours in two jurisdictions here, that incredible case of that woman that was attacked on Black Horse Avenue off Bagot Road, off Dunavon Road near the Phoenix Park in Dublin, attacked by this 23-year-old man called Martin Gallagher, who she was out walking. She's a very, very fit woman, thankfully, for her own sake at this stage. A very, very fit woman, walked 10k a day, swam, was a swimming teacher. I was out walking and walked by this car, and this man was at the boot of the car, and he attempted to and succeeded, except for this woman's incredible bravery and strength. He got her into the boot of the car, started slamming the boot of the car on her shins to try and get her in. She struggled. How she did it, I do not know. She struggled and managed to prise her way out of the boot. She grabbed an item of his clothing that was lying in the boot. He then grabbed her again and tried to force her into the back of the car. And luckily, this was 7:30 in the morning, luckily a man driving who got confused, as I think a lot of people, he didn't know what was going on. He thought it was somebody trying to get a child into the car to go to school or whatever. But he became suspicious, and miraculously, and to his great, great credit, he stopped the car, his car, reversed back. And between the heroic efforts of the victim and Eric Doran's effort, they managed to free her, and he brought her home. She was in such shock because, as she revealed in her victim impact statement, she was then minding and the carer for her husband, who had dementia, who unfortunately died in October last. And one of the reasons she was out walking so early, well, it's not that early in the world we live in, 7:30 in the morning, was that was the time when her husband slept, and she could get a bit of air or whatever. And in her victim impact statement, she talks about the effect it has had on her life. She still suffers from nightmares. Her heart jumps if she's out and a runner passes by. She said, "My life is only a fragment of what it was, and I suffer from many flashbacks a day." And Seamus Troy was saying much the same. And then we have that awful case unfolding in London of Sarah Everard, the young woman who disappeared at 9 o'clock at night, walking along what was supposedly a safe area, and remains have been found, and a man has been arrested in connection with her murder, as they're saying, and he's a serving member. Now, Mary Lynch, Mary, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, Joe.
Not that you need anything to bring it all back up, but those confluence of those, beginning with Seamus Troy and his programme, has brought it all back to you. You were 2007, a completely unprovoked attack when you were working as a taxi driver.
That's correct, yeah. I picked up the guy and brought him to Virginia, and we were down at Cul-de-sac, and he got out of the car. I thought he was going to do a rubber, and he opened the car door and proceeded to kick me into the car. He then bit me on my bare skin. He tried choking me. I was black and blue. He pulled lumps of hair out of my head, and this all happened like at 3 o'clock in the morning.
Oh, God. and the after effects of that attack. I'll talk, we'll talk shortly about what happened to this man, Jerry McGrath, and what he went on to do horrifically. But the after effects of the attack on you, Mary, even today.
Yes, it stays with you forever. It stays with you forever. And that's why I rang in when I heard that Nan was saying that he didn't want to go in court. That is the worst thing. You need to be in the court. You need to, and it's like you're supposed to be encouraged to go. Because if you have a judge hearing a case and he has got the person in front of him who did the deed and you don't have a victim there, it's like reading a story off a page. You're hearing from somebody else's voice talking about you. But you're, this man, the judge will have no one to look at that it was me it happened to or this man that it happened to. You're not, you're, you know what I mean? You're not human. It's just like a story and somebody else is reading it.
And when this woman who was attacked savagely on Blackhorse Avenue, when she says, I have nightmares, I jump when I'm out on the road and if someone runs past me.
Yes. I never used to wear earphones when I'm out walking, and my husband got me some for Christmas.
Yeah.
And I was walking along and someone came up behind me that I knew and put their hand on my shoulder and I nearly, you know.
Yeah.
So then I didn't wear them then for the rest of that walk.
And then,
you know,
and in your home, Mary, what do you do?
Oh, well, in my home, my doors are locked. I lock all my doors inside.
Oh, your interior doors as well as your exterior doors?
Oh, yes. All doors are locked at night time.
Wow.
Every door is locked at night time. Because it's just, you just, like, you now know what's going to happen. That's the awful thing about, you know, like before this, I would never have thought of this. You know, I would have never thought somebody could break in or it wouldn't, I could think about it, but it wouldn't worry me that much. Now I'm wondering, if they break in, what can I do? What will I do? And then I lock the doors. I say, well, if they have to break in through here, I'll hear the noise and I can ring the guards or, you know, all that business. Or I can get out the bedroom window or that sort of thing.
And why weren't you in court, Mary?
Because I was told, well, first of all, I got a phone call on the Saturday before the court to say that my case was not going ahead on the Monday.
Mm-hmm.
And that was fine. I was very disappointed because I had myself geared up to go and because they knew, the guards knew I wanted to go because I had said it often enough. And so I heard no more and until the Monday evening, a man who I'd never spoken to before, who gave me his name, I didn't know who he was. And as far as I knew, he had nothing to do with my case. He told me that, as he said, your man got 9 months. But
nine
he only
months.
Got 9 months. You see, my case, it happened to me in April. It was in a district court, and yet it took till after the following Christmas to go to court. So in that time, he had then attacked a child and murdered a woman.
Yeah.
But my big thing was not being in the court because I don't know what was said. Now, I was told that they put up a great case, but I don't know. I wasn't there. That judge didn't look at me and said, this is the woman that was beaten up by this man.
Going about your work, completely unprovoked.
Yeah.
Okay, Mary, and this man, Jerry McGrath, went on to murder Sylvia Roach Kelly.
That's right.
Savagely, and he attacked a child as well.
That's correct. In October.
He broke into a house, didn't he?
Yes,
that's my
memory. Kicked the child out of the house.
Okay, Mary, stay with us, please, because I want to talk to Sinead O'Leary. Sinead, good afternoon.
Hi, how are you?
You're on WhatsApp. And Sinead, these events that we're hearing about from Blackhorse Avenue to London to Seamus Troy, who's from, his attack happened in Europe, in Cork. It brings back the horrific events that visited your life in 2002. You and your friend,
yes,
Nicholas Sweeney.
Yeah.
You were at, and you were in the safety you thought of.
Of Nicola's home,
yeah.
You know, you hear wrong place, wrong time. We were exactly where we should be of a Saturday evening in the safety of her home when an intruder broke in. We didn't know him. He lived nearby. He had already had previous convictions. He was known in the area. earlier that night, he caused a commotion in a bar, tried to smash a glass ashtray on a barman's head. The guards came to the scene. He was told to go home because there was a summons waiting for him for a previous attack on two girls on the New Year's Eve 4 months prior. And on his way home, he spotted a boy on the road and he was going to murder him with a rock. He decided it would be too messy. He went home and got some knives. And that's when he was attracted to Nicola's house. He scaled the gates, came in the back door, came up to her room. He didn't speak and just immediately launched a vicious attack on me, stamped on me and threw me to the ground. And then pulled out, showed Nicola the knives in his belt and started stabbing me. I was stabbed nearly 20 times. I was just fortunate enough that I was able to use my arms to defend my vital organs. And then when he probably assumed I was dead at that stage, he ran to Nicola, who tried to lock herself in her ensuite, but her towel got stuck under the door. And Nicola was stabbed 11 times and she died in her room. And then he left. Then I fled to a bathroom and he left the house. Mm-hmm. He went home, he showered, and he returned to the scene of the crime, acting like a concerned neighbour while my family was there, the guards were there. And everything at that stage, it was just a motiveless crime. It was just no rhyme or reason for it at all.
And Peter Whelan stood outside the gate as the families arrived, the property, the ambulance arrived.
He stood outside. He stood outside the front door when my parents were there, as I had rang my parents for help as well after I'd alerted the guards.
Now, I know, given the horror of that and the death of poor Nicola, your friend, a daughter, a sister, you don't need anything to bring that back. That's with you. But just listening to the Sarah Everard case, Seamus Try on Monday, and this case on Black Horse Avenue, what does that say to you, Sinead, in terms of your since the horrific attack and the murder of Nicola? Do you take extra precautions? Do you suffer flashbacks?
It changes your life completely, suffering that level of a trauma. And particularly, I mean, for me, it was constantly in the media because of all his appeals. He was unremorseful. Yeah. His appealing was relentless. 2 years ago, we were in the position where Nicola's family and I were under the impression that he would have been about 2 or 3 years in his life sentence for Nicola's murder at that stage. And then we found out because of a prime time investigation that he had had 3 or 4 illegal parole hearings and was having day releases back in Cork. And that completely derailed my life. I'd worked very hard for a very long time to regain some sense of peace and security in my life, and that has taken all of that from me. I mean, I was the state witness in a murder trial, and yet I wasn't included in those parole hearings. Neither were Nicola's parents. We weren't given any opportunity to submit victim impact statements, and for us to find out that he had been back in Cork, where we all live, on numerous occasions was absolutely devastating and traumatizing for all of us. And it's the last 2 years now have been horrendous for us all, you know.
And nobody came near you when Peter Whelan was, before he was got temporary release or day release, to call it.
No, as in we should have been able to submit victim impact statements. We should have been made aware of those parole hearings. It's a really important part of the process. Mm-hmm. You know, we were never acknowledged. We've never been considered. I mean, I campaign for exclusion zones for families bereaved by murder. I don't think that those families should ever have to live alongside those people. I think it's inhumane. I mean, at this stage, it's for me, I just feel completely disposable by the state as a witness. Mm. I feel like that not only is my mental health at stake moving forward, but my own personal safety. I mean, the only regrets he expressed were that he didn't do more to kill me. You know, and I now live in a position where I'm waiting for, there's a parole hearing underway at the moment. I'm waiting to be emailed to be told if he's being released or not. And based on that, I would have to uproot my whole life and move away to protect myself.
And do you think, is there a parole hearing going on at the moment, Sinead, as far as you know?
There is. It was scheduled for November and we're still waiting to hear what the outcome of that was. You know, that's, so you're living in that moment too. You know, it's frightening.
And have you been asked to submit?
Yes, I have this time because I found out about it. So I was able to submit this time.
And what way, what way did you make that submission, Sinead? Did you write it or could you?
I wrote it. I mean, under the new Parole Act, once that is up and running, you should be able to submit orally and hopefully with a bit more support, which needs to happen. So this was a written statement this time, whereas, you know, I would be campaigning for more support and more rights for victims in that sense as well, and more support when they are undergoing these parole hearings.
And in making the submission, first of all, I take your point about being allowed to make it orally, but also it can be very difficult to write it down.
Extremely. And there's a lot of pressure there too.
Yeah.
You know, you're having to relive, you get 3 weeks to do it. You know, that took every minute of every day for 3 weeks out of me writing that. You're having to revisit all of that trauma and you're having to write to the person who committed these crimes against you. It's not private. You're only allowed to submit once you acknowledge that they will be receiving a copy, which I feel makes me even more vulnerable because I'm putting up roadblocks to his release in that sense.
He can read it. His legal team can read it. And
I'm not allowed to submit unless I give permission for him to read it.
And
whereas I wouldn't have access to anything that he's submitted or anything that he says in his parole hearings, and neither does Nicola's family. You know, it's a very unbalanced system.
And Sinead, you said you spent 3 weeks writing it.
Yeah. Yeah.
How did you do that? How did you keep together?
Well, it was difficult, but you know, I'm fighting for my survival and I'm fighting for my rights and I'm fighting for Nicola. You know,
you're fighting for other victims as well, especially in your case and Mary's case, and the Black Horse Avenue case, as we're calling it, women attacked, completely unprovoked attacks, and the aftermath and what can happen. And your worry is that wheel. And how many pages was your submission for a finish?
It was about 9,000 words. I wrote a lot. I put my heart and soul into it. It was a lot. Do you know,
that's incredible. And what way did you structure it? Were you given guidance on how to structure it?
No, nothing at all. Nothing at all. I mean, I just started from the start, what happened that night and what the real and lasting effect that has had on me, you know, and to know the events of that night. I mean, I could say even 10 years after that night, I still wasn't able to go to the bathroom in the middle of the night because I would live in fear that my whole family could have been massacred, because that's the reality that I lived in, that someone could come into your home and kill your loved ones, you know.
And Sinead, I just think that's an incredible achievement on so many levels. One, that you were able to sit down and write 9,000 words. It's a short novel, to say the least.
Yeah, and I think people underestimate how difficult it is to actually do that, and particularly for family members to have to do that, and they feel as if that's their only avenue to get justice. You know, it's and there's no support when you're doing that. You know, no one's sitting beside you helping you with that. You know, it was a very difficult time doing that for me. You know, you want to be able to move on with your life, to be able to live your life despite of what's happened. But there's no space to do that.
And as you say, the shadow on your shoulder when you're writing it is that this man, this murderer, I know that people will take issue with that and face the charges, but this man will read this and this man could be out on the streets of your city very soon.
Yeah. You know, it's very intimidating, and it's, you know, but I mean, he attempted to take my life, so I have to continue to fight for my life, you know.
And Mary, where is Gerry McGrath now? I know he's in for the horrific killing of Sylvia, and he broke into a house and tried to abduct a child from her bed. Where is he now, Mary? Are you kept abreast of where he is and what's happening?
No, I did fight because I have actually no rights because I didn't die. So I really have no rights. The family, Sibby Roach Kelly's family, will be informed when he's getting out, but I would have had no rights. But now I have because I got on to the prison service and I spoke to people and they're to ring me when he's getting out.
So you made yourself heard?
Yes, I made myself heard, all right. But it doesn't do, you see, the problem is victims get nothing. The victims get nothing. We get, like, I wasn't even allowed to go to that court, which is something I really wanted to do. But we get nothing. Like, remember that the person who does the crime gets psychiatric help. They get barristers. They get solicitors. They have everything there for them.
Yeah.
Victims don't have that. Victims have nothing. And nobody, you know, and once it's over, you're sort of like, if you say anything or talk about it afterwards, you're nearly told, well, if you stop talking about it, you'll get over it, you'll be fine. Or why are you doing the job? Like what was said to me, you're not still doing the job, are you? And I said, well, yes, I am. I don't have a choice. I pay to pay bills. But they were, well, you shouldn't be doing that. You're a woman. But I should be doing it.
And I don't want the name of the person, but what was the status of the person that said that to you?
They were just an ordinary, everyday person
who
would have known me and some a relation with another one.
As if your job was somehow at fault.
Yes.
I
was at fault for doing the job. Yeah. It'd be more like it.
Yeah, sorry, yeah.
You know, absolutely. And like that's what people say. People say, like, that woman in England, it's what would be said about her is, why was she walking at that hour? The woman from Blackhall that you've just been speaking to, why was she going out at 7 o'clock in the morning for a walk on her own? Why not? Is my answer. Why not?
Yeah, and I don't know whether you heard Sarah Grace, that the victim of sexual assault, was on McClare this morning. And she was saying, and Sinead, you resonate with this, she was a victim of sexual assault. Mm. And when she went for counselling, it subsequently emerged that her counselling notes in a private counselling, Sarah, private in that she had to pay for it herself,
yes,
her notes could be subpoenaed by the perpetrator's lawyers. For them to go over her private notes, to obviously go over and see if they find a glitch in it. That's their job. Horrific stuff. And Sinead, in terms of, you mentioned precautions. And I see you, at one stage you said, I lived in Central America and you had pepper spray. Pepper spray is legal.
Yeah.
And then I'm trying to loop that into what you said very starkly earlier on, that if Peter Whelan gets out, you're going to have to get out of Cork.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, for many years I had a German Shepherd, a rescue dog, who was very protective of me.
Okay.
She was the only way I could leave the house. That was the only way I could go walking, you know, kind of thing. And it's like, you're hyper alert and you're hyper aware that these things could happen to you. And it's, again, the same as Mary is saying, there's no support for victims. It's almost as if we're the criminals.
Yeah.
It's mental. You know, there's nothing for us going forward.
Yeah, and the other thing is, we get one letter from the guards to say, phone this number if you want to get some help, or, you know, for a bit of counselling. That's it. It's a standard letter that goes out to everybody.
Yeah, and that trauma is ongoing for life, you know. It's a lifelong sentence when you've been traumatised.
This man gets life, but he's going to be out in 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? I have a life sentence that I have to live till the day I die now. Sarah there has a life sentence that she has to live for the rest of her life.
Mm-hmm.
And we've done nothing wrong.
I'll take a break because more people want to talk to us. But we're talking to Mary Lynch, who contacted us after the interview on Monday with Seamus Troy. This unprovoked interview. And the fact that Seamus said there's no counselling, he's deeply, deeply affected by it. The savagery of the attack, and there was no counselling afterwards. And then in the meantime, that horrific attack on Black Horse Avenue, where that incredible woman managed to escape, and that incredible man, Eric Dorn, managed to help. And the perpetrator, Martin Gallagher, who apparently it made some difference that he had no previous convictions, apparently, and was from a good family, as the phrase goes. He got 6 years for that. And then Sinead O'Leary, her friend Nicola Sweeney, was murdered in her own house, in her own bathroom, by Peter Whelan, completely unprovoked. Sinead was stabbed 20 times. And then they discovered a few years ago, Whelan, by the way, got a life sentence for murdering Nicola and 15 years for the, it's both to run concurrently, by the way, 15 years for the attempted murder of Sinead. But that in the meantime, he has been allowed out, Whelan has been allowed out in Cork City on temporary release. And Sinead, or indeed the grieving family of Nicola Sweeney, were totally unaware of this. Stay with us, 51551, my chance after this break.
Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815.
It's emerged now that that the woman has been mentioned by both Sinead and Mary Sarah Everard, who was walking home at 9 o'clock at night in London. That the man who is accused of abducting and murdering Sarah used his police ID to inveigle her into a car because her family said she would never go off with a stranger. I don't think any woman would in this day and age, but in terms of protection and precautions. By the way, Sinead, I don't know if you pepper spray is illegal in Ireland, isn't it?
Yeah, it's illegal here, yes.
Did you ever find out why, or is it because they think it would get into the wrong hands? Or
I actually don't know why. Yeah. I just know I wouldn't be able to get my hands on it if I wanted it.
And what about? Is there alarms out there you can carry? Or
I know. What's an alarm going to do?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm looking into getting a personal protection dog for my, because that's how I feel I would have peace of mind. Is to have a security dog with me, you know, because I wouldn't feel safe with Whelan back in Cork, you know.
And you don't.
Just what we were saying about our case, his sentencing was actually consecutive. It was the first.
Oh, was it? Okay, okay.
It was.
Rightly so,
late Judge Carney ruled because of the outrage of the case.
The horror,
and the danger that he posed to society. That's why it's been such a frightening journey for Nicola's family and I, is that he hasn't even fulfilled that sentence when he was getting these day releases, you know.
He was successful. As you say, he appealed and appealed. They were vexatious appeals, to say the least, Sinead. He appealed everywhere.
It was an assault on the judicial system. He appealed for 8 years in every which way that he could, you know. There's never been any accountability for taking Nicola's life or trying to take mine. It's frightening that someone of that nature will be released back into society, and who's next, you know, and who's going to take responsibility for that.
He succeeded in getting the 15-year sentence for the attempted murder of you, Sinead, reduced to 11. And do we know how many times he's been out on day release?
Three or four. I know he was due for one, but with the pandemic restrictions in February, that one didn't go ahead.
Oh, he'd probably go to court over that as well, Sinead.
Yeah, I'm sure he will, you know. Yeah, I mean, his time in prison.
You just finished, Sinead. Yeah, sorry.
Yeah. I mean, it's clear that his time in prison hasn't been one of reflection or accountability for the crimes that he's committed. It's just been a manner of fighting for his release, which is absolutely frightening that someone of that caliber will be back on the streets again.
And just to remind our listeners, he pleaded guilty.
Yes.
And his appeals are against the sentencing.
Mm-hmm.
So that's beyond belief at this stage. It's beyond belief.
It really is. And I remember fighting for 2 years now, fighting this. There's no peace at all, and there's no peace for Nicola's family. You know, it's shocking the way the system works and what they're faced with. They live their own, as Mary's saying, they're living their own life sentences. They will forever live with the loss of their daughter, and now they're not supported or considered at all by the state. It's shocking. Yeah. It's really disgraceful.
And Sinead, in your own case, have you said or told your family that if this murderer gets out into Cork City, where he lives, and where you live, that you would feel you'd have to move?
Yeah, they know that. And
Do
that's been,
okay.
I mean, I, they understand that I'd have to, and they lost me for many years because I left Ireland because of the situation, you know. And I know the Nicholas family would feel the same, that their lives would be unlivable if they had to live alongside him, you know. And that's what it is. It's these murderers are, they're reintroduced in society without any regard for the families at all. You know, it's inhumane. It really is. There has to be exclusion zones in this country for cases like that, you know.
Now, I know when I was a probation officer at Sinead many years ago, and because I was a man in the service, I seemed to get a lot of men who had been in prison for, as it happened, murder. But they were of an age when they got out. Now, in other words, they were in their 50s when they got out. But one of the first things, and when you had the power to do it, one of the first things I remember saying to one man, no more details will I give, but that he was from Limerick. And I said to him, if you go next or near Limerick, I will put you back in the, you had the power to go back to court and tell the judge that he had broken his, they're out on license as such.
Yeah.
Now, the way, what you've done is so...
Well, I know in the past, so powerful. It's been within the Justice Minister's power to enact an exclusion zone, but there's no channel for those families to request one, do you know? Mm. And that's where the failing is as well.
Yeah.
Because you have no voice, you have no say, you know?
No. Mary, sorry, you want to come in there?
Well, no, it's just to say that there is no rehabilitation, remember, for these people.
No, there's not.
So
no,
they're
going to come out. Yeah.
They're going to come out and do it again. This is the way these people are made. This is what they're going to do again.
Yeah.
And even if they have an exclusion zone for Cork for this guy,
mm-hmm.
he can move up to Meads or.
Yeah,
Mayo
exactly.
Or anywhere, and do the same thing again.
Because they say there's only one prison in the country that actually meets the recommended ratio for prisoner to psychologist. And these are the people that are supposed to be making the decisions on release. But the prison service itself doesn't put that much importance on them when you look at the pay grade. I know that the pay grade for a prison counsellor in Cork last year was only €14.
An hour.
Yeah.
But it's unbelievable to think that these people can just walk out again.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing when they say, oh, they come from a good family and there was nothing else there before, they were never known to the guards before, they had to have been. They didn't, like, Jerry Maguire didn't start his mm-hmm. mother's thing with me.
Yeah.
And do you know what I mean? He didn't start with me. There had to have been something before, even though, like she said, it was... that he came from a good family, blah, blah, blah.
And it was the same with Peter Whelan. There was a history of very disordered, violent behaviour. I mean, I know there was one instance of breaking into a creche and urinating on children's toys. And do you know what I mean? A real disordered violent behaviour, you know?
Disturbed. Lucy O'Sullivan has contacted us on 1857-15815. Lucy, you're listening to Mary and Sinead.
Hi, Joe Hiding.
Yeah, you're 25. You want to remind people that there is a feature on if you have an iPhone, a smartphone.
Yeah, I only just found out about it today, but it turns out my sister has had it set up all along. But on an iPhone, if you press the side button, so the lock button, 6 times, it sets off an alarm where you are. So, like, a really loud alarm. So, let's say if you're in an attack, that would, I suppose, draw attention to people in the area. And then it also calls the emergency services and sends a message to whoever you have set up on your phone as emergency contact.
So you press, I haven't heard about this, you press your lock button on your phone 6 times and it sets off a high-pitched sound.
Yeah.
And
it also rings 999.
And does it tell 999 where you are, or 999 can hear you?
I don't know. I haven't actually used it. I presume they can just hear you. But I think, so it sends a text to contact on your phone. It's different on different phones. So I have a Samsung, and on my phone it doesn't ring the emergency services, but it sends a message to whoever you have set up as your emergency contact. And it sends them a picture from your front and rear camera and an audio recording of where you are.
Okay, it says press and hold the side button on one of the and one of the volume buttons until the emergency. Well, people can look it up themselves.
Yeah, I think look it up for your specific phone.
And Lucy, when did you put this on your phone?
Only now. I saw it on, so after what happened in the UK.
After the Sarah Everard case, yeah.
Exactly, yeah. And then what's happening in Dublin, there's been so much talk on social media about it. And I just saw that someone had put up a post saying that this feature existed. I didn't know it existed.
And would you be worried about out on your own, Lucy?
Yeah, sometimes you would be, sometimes you wouldn't be. I know that, let's say, if I've spoken about this with my friends, so we've all had incidences of, you know, you feel fine walking along on your own, but then you also do the usual things of, you know, you don't wear earphones when you're walking in the dark, or tucking in your hair if you're in a dodgy spot or anything like that. And they're sort of things that you don't do as... You don't realise that you're worried, but you do them automatically.
Okay.
Realistically, they shouldn't. I don't think there should be things that you have to do, you know?
And what did you say, Lucy, tucking in your hair?
So, like, let's say if you're walking along the street on your own and it's in the dark.
Okay.
If you are wearing a coat or something with a high collar, if you tuck in your hair, or if you do certain things like that, you're more likely to look like a man then, or you're less likely to look like a woman, possibly, and therefore draw less attention, you know?
And when you talk to your pals, Lucy, female pals especially... do you talk about precautions? Do you know the whole thing? Make sure you have your if you have keys, try and
between your fingers and all that sort of thing. We don't talk about them all the time or anything. I suppose the conversation has come up a few times, but we'd always like, you know, that automatic thing of being like, text me when you get home, or, you know, let me know that you're home safe and all that sort of thing. They're just really automatic that, you know, you just do them without thinking.
Yeah.
But it's just the fact that those are automatic things that you do, I think, is quite telling in the first place, you know?
Yeah, says it all. Okay.
There should be self-defence taught in schools, do you know? I do think at this stage, I don't think any young woman should be in fear, you know?
No, but I think there should also be education for boys on...
Oh, of course.
Firstly, what to do and what not to do, and then secondly, what to look out for on the street to actually protect people on the street, you know? Instead of just, like, instead of all this education on don't go out at night, you know, put the keys between your finger, all this sort of stuff, I think there should be a big, big emphasis on educating boys and men and everyone on how to look out for these sort of incidents happening and how to protect them in this situation and on what not to do, you know, to make people feel vulnerable on the street.
And the person who came to the aid of that woman who was subject to that savage attack and abduction on Blackhorse Avenue in Dublin was a man, Eric Doran. So he stopped, thankfully, even though we're trying to judge it from the court, but even though he initially thought it was somebody, as everyone does, you think it's something else, you think it's somebody bundling something or somebody messing or playing, but he did stop and he did reverse and he did get out of his car and he did save that woman. Which is incredible. But I take that point, and so does Sinead. And Sinead made it earlier, I didn't get to it, that men have to be educated, boys have to be educated as well. This is one, absolutely, totally, completely not on. And two, if you do see it, stop it. If you do see it, and if any of your buddies are behaving in any way untoward towards women, you take a position of not tolerating that. Someone in a group of lads always has to take a leadership position. And if that means, right, lads, we're all getting out of here, this is looking too messy, and you walk away. Sinead, in terms of your life, you were 19 when this happened, which Whelan was around the same age, wasn't he?
Yeah, he'd be 38 now, you know, and looking at being released is frightening, you know.
A very young man.
Mm-hmm.
You are a very young woman. Okay, Marion is in Malahide. Now, Marion, your point, please. joe@rt.ie. Yes, please, Marion. Hello, Marion. Okay, I'm going to take a break because it's now 27 minutes past 2. joe@rt.ie.
Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815.
And joe@rt.ie. It's pursuant to a call we had on Monday. We had it last Friday, but we only got to it on Monday from Seamus Troy, who'd been an unprovoked attack, and he talked about the effects on him afterwards, contacted by Mary Lynch, who's on the line, who was savagely attacked by, when she was out working and driving a taxi, unprovoked again, Jerry McGrath, who got less than a year in prison for, and Mary knew nothing of it. She wasn't in court, didn't give a victim impact statement. Then he went on to attempted abduction of a child from a house and then went on to murder a young woman, subsequently Sylvia Roach Kelly. And Sinead O'Leary in 2002, Sinead and her pal, her buddy, two of them, were getting ready to, on a night out in the privacy and sanctuary of Nicola's own home and bedroom and bathroom, when this man broke in, Peter Whelan, and murdered Nicola and savagely tried to murder Sinead. And both of them are talking about the after effects and also about the perpetrators, and the issues are also resonant of, one, what's happening in London with that woman, Sarah Everard. God help her and her family at the minute. And also the woman who was abducted on Black Horse Avenue, and the case came up yesterday for sentence, and the man, Martin Gallagher from Hartstown in Dublin, got 6 years in prison. Rachel, good afternoon.
Hi, Joe. How are you?
Hiya. I'm so sorry that this has happened to you, Rachel, and I'm so sorry that that you have to talk about it publicly, but you want to.
I want to. Yeah.
Okay. What happened, Rachel?
2.5 years ago, I was raped, and I went to the Gardaí and reported it, and they were fantastic.
Yeah.
And they pursued it, and they, you know, did whatever they had to do, and they brought it to the DPP, but the DPP wouldn't prosecute. Even though the Gardaí said that I would have made a very good witness, mm-hmm. because you're a witness in your own, you know, in your own thing. And I appealed the DPP's decision, but they upheld it, and the man will never be prosecuted now. And basically, what I'm saying is, they actually said in the letter to me that they weren't taking sides. You know, they weren't taking anyone's word over anyone else, but they have done. Because they've taken his word over mine.
Yeah.
I was raped, and they said there wasn't enough evidence, even though the CCTV confirmed where I was, when I said I was, and where he was. And everything showed up, you know.
Mm-hmm.
He admitted to having sex with me, but they took his word over my word, saying that he didn't rape me. And but he did rape me, and it was violent.
And have you been to counselling, or are you?
Yes, I'm attending counselling. Yes, now, yes,
yeah.
Yes, yeah. Well, you know, I just feel people, because men as well as women can get raped, but people, if they say that something happens, they should be given the opportunity to face their abuser, mm-hmm. or the perpetrator in court,
yeah.
and let their jury decide.
Yeah,
you know, and not the DPP.
And you were willing to do that, Rachel?
Oh yes, absolutely. Yeah. I was willing to go so far as to name this man, and I would have given my own identity.
You were prepared to go public as well.
I was prepared to go public and name this man, because I just know this was not his first.
You believe it?
Yeah. He was well practiced. He knew exactly what he was doing, and he groomed me. And it sounds funny for a woman of my age saying I was groomed, but he groomed me. He made me believe that he was respectable and he was decent.
He was a predator.
He was a predator. Oh, that is exactly what he was, Joe, a predator.
And when you look back on his behaviour and his groom, his behaviour was predacious, as you say. He had one object in mind. When you put that frame on it in retrospect,
That's exactly what he was. And he wasn't a bit afraid or anything. And the Garda that dealt with my case was exceptional.
Yeah.
You know? He was he was so sorry that it wasn't going to be prosecuted. And the work that, you know, he put into it, and he'd done everything right. And, you know, commended me for my recall of what had happened. I had given details, and I said, you know, they checked it out with CCTV and where I was, when I was, and everything like that. And this guy was a predator, exactly what he was. And the DPP, I'm just waiting for the Gardaí to ring me again after somebody else reports him as a rapist.
Yeah.
And maybe they'll take my word then.
And did you tell your family, friends, Rachel?
Yes, I did, yes. My family are great support. My friends are great support. The counsellor, she's wonderful support as well. You know? And it's just the unfairness of not being believed when something serious as this happens. And I'm not a young one. You know, I'm not a young one. I'm well into my 50s, Joe. And if this had happened to a young girl, God help us, and what they'd have to go through for the rest of their lives. Because I've experience behind me to help me cope with it.
Yeah. And can I ask, in terms of, again, his predaceous behaviour, how did he establish contact? How did you?
I met him. I'm on my own. I'm divorced, you know, on my own. And it was actually my family who encouraged me to go online, ma'am. Go on, you know, online. Yeah. So okay, I did. And that's how I met him, online. And my family are devastated because they had encouraged me. But, I mean, obviously, it's not their fault, no more than it's my fault, you know. So that's how I met him, online. And, you know, I've been talking to him by email and by text and by phone for weeks beforehand. And then I met him. And then the second time I met him, that's what happened. He raped me. Very practiced. He knew exactly what he was going to do and how he was going to do it and where.
Good God.
Yeah. But I can't give any details because...
Yeah, I know, I understand that. But Rachel, I'm also very, very struck. And I hear it in Sinead and I hear it in Mary as well, that the vividness of your recall, you say the guard investigating was really impressed with the detail. I'm also recalling that woman on Blackhorse Avenue again, that when she was bundled into the boot of that man's car who was trying to abduct her, she managed, as she tried to kick her way out, as he's slamming the boot down on her shins, she managed to grab something from the boot of the car and hold on to it. That turned out to be his sweater, which was very important in terms of convicting him. Yes. And I just think that level of keeping your wits about you is just incredible, Rachel. You say you were able to remember things that fitted with CCTV coverage subsequently.
Because you're living in that moment. It's crystallized in your mind. And when it happened to me, Joe, two serious murders had happened to women. One a young girl and one a woman in Wicklow where she was abducted. And that had only happened 2 weeks prior to, and that was what was going through my head as I was being raped. And I kept saying to myself, keep in the moment. All I needed, what I kept saying to myself was, I have to get home. I have to get home. I just want to get home. So it was so vivid. Everything was so vivid. And I think it's because you're living in that moment and you're putting all your energy into surviving that it remains to be clear and crystallised, as you say.
Stay with us, Rachel. Mary, did you recognise, how did they catch this fella, Jerry McGrath, your perpetrator?
Well, I talked him down because he had the keys of my car. And
I thought he may have thrown in the field, but I couldn't. The car, he turned off my car and took the keys out. But what actually happened was the key broke, and it was one of those keys, you know, that has the battery thing in it.
Yeah.
And I talked him down eventually. When I stopped screaming, he calmed down. That was the thing. And when I kept just saying to him, why are you doing this? Why are you doing this to me? I said, I will get you help. Give me my key and we will drive into Virginia and get some coffee and I will ring my friend to get you help. And I named my friend, who was a nun. And I kept my voice really low. He then started to say, oh, I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I'm sorry. And I kept saying, well, thank you very much for apologising. Thank you very much for apologising. So I could feel he was in my car then, because I knew where I was, I would never be found. So I had to get back into Virginia. So I got him into the car and I put my boot down and got into Virginia. And the whole way he kept saying he was sorry. And I just kept rubbing his arm and saying, well, thank you for saying you're sorry. And I kept my voice low.
My God.
But I could feel
my
him.
God.
My husband was ringing me because what happened with me, I have an earpiece.
Okay.
And I had pressed the button on it because my phone, he threw my phone on the floor, so I couldn't have just pressed those buttons. And it phoned my husband and he could hear me screaming. And I was trying to say where I was, but I couldn't describe where I was because I just had to say Virginia, somewhere around Virginia.
Yeah.
And he could hear all this screaming. And he's also a taxi driver, so he had people in his car.
Yeah.
And he didn't know what to do, and he phoned the guards. But the guards started phoning me. But every time the phone had ringed, he had picked up my phone. He was trying to cut it off, but I had the earpiece in. I got the earpiece, and I kept it, and I had the earpiece in. So I kept talking and saying, oh, thank you, George, pretending it was George, not the guards.
Okay.
You know, and that's the way it was. But I was just going to say, there's Jerry McGrath was out on bail for me when he attacked this child.
Yeah.
And got out on bail a second time.
And murdered Sylvia.
And then murdered Sylvia Roach Kelly. Because my case, I had been ringing up about my case all the time. And they said they were waiting for the file to come back from DPP. Since then, and since the murder, I have found out my file didn't go to the DPP till after the child was attacked. In about 3 weeks after that, it would have been thrown out anyway for being too late. So they're going to have to do something about bail.
Yeah.
This thing about bail.
Yeah.
You know, out twice on bail. That's when he murdered Sylvia Roach Kelly.
Yeah.
Because he was out the second time on bail.
And Mary, looking back on it, do you know where you got those incredible reserves of courage, tenacity, to be able to say to him, I will help you, come on, and persuade him to get into your car, because you knew that was the only way you were going to get out of there,
is
by driving. And he's in the car with you, having savagely attacked you.
Yep, I don't know. And the thing about it was, I always say somebody up there was looking after me and kept me calm, because when I was screaming, he was going mental. He was actually enjoying the screaming, I think. But when I calmed right down, he seemed to calm down. And that was the thing about, that was the weird thing about it all, you know. But I remember driving in and in my head I was saying, please God, let me get in here quick and safe. Because I didn't want to crash either. And I was shaking, I was thinking of all this. So it was all that, it was just that something comes into you and you start to fight. And I don't know where it comes from, you know, but he then got out of my car, and then when the guard started to talk to me, I then poked down.
Yeah,
but I didn't before that. Then at that stage, you know, but then I had to go to the hospital and all the rest of all the business then after that. But like it's just this thing about bail has to be sorted.
Okay, yeah.
They're going to have to sort out this bail thing, because if you let somebody out on bail for a second time. Like, this was because work wasn't done on my case, remember?
And it was different parts of the country, wasn't it? Virginia, Tipperary, Limerick.
But they were all saying, like, the fella in Tipperary, the policeman or the guard in Tipperary was saying he ran an unnamed station and spoke to an unnamed guard. in my case, but it couldn't possibly have done. It's on the pulse system.
Yeah.
You know, where it happened.
And Sinead, in your case, how was Peter Whelan caught?
So he was back outside at the
house,
scene,
yeah.
And I was inside with yeah. the detectives. You see, they thought I was going to die there. I was losing so much blood, but I gave a description of him
yeah.
and it matched the physical description of who was outside. He obviously was well known for the guards, for them to even, they had radioed each other saying, look, there's a fella outside who matches the description. So they took him away for a walk, and he became, after a few minutes, even boastful, asking what was the scene like inside. And, you know, it was just disgusting. Like, you know.
And when you're describing it to the, which is incredible, Sinead, now you have 20 stab wounds, mother of good God. And did you know at that stage that your pal Nicola had passed?
No.
But
so
I was very much
holding it together
yeah,
because I knew
yeah.
we needed help.
And you knew
so
you
I
need,
rang
you...
my family as well.
Yeah.
You know, I was ringing every avenue to get us help because, I mean, he was still around as well to my knowledge. And it was just trying to get us help and get us out of there, you know.
And afterwards, when Mary said, you heard Mary's incredible story, Rachel's incredible story of how, and even I say that woman on Black Horse Avenue, she's in a boot of a car, she's trying to scramble out. He is slamming the boot down on her shins, trying to break her legs or whatever. And
I'm heartbroken for that woman with what she's left with for the later years of her life have been taken from her.
Yeah.
You know, it's horrendous what
yeah, she
will now mentally suffer.
Now.
Yeah, and she won't, you know, that's it. It's all been taken from her. All her safety and security has been completely taken from her. You know, it's heartbreaking.
Stay with us, please, because we've more callers, including a woman who actually was attacked, but her perpetrator, and we will name him, she wants to name him, he has been named after this break, was sent to prison. Joe at RT.ie.
Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815.
More important number than 1850 715 today is the Rape Crisis National Centre number. It's a 24-hour helpline. It's 1800 77 8888. That's the Rape Crisis Centre, 1-800-77-8888. Catherine, good afternoon.
Hi, how are you?
Yeah, good, thanks. And again, I'm sorry what happened, Catherine. Tell us, it began with a trip to what we used to know as the video libraries when they were around.
Yeah.
And what happened?
So I was going in one night, and as I went in the door, this man grabbed my arm. And when I turned, he was foaming at the mouth, so I pulled away naturally and went inside. It was very weird that he was foaming at the mouth. I didn't know. I'd never seen somebody like that, so I didn't know what the story was. But I just presumed he was on drugs, and so I stayed in the video library until it was safe to leave. And then I went back to my apartment, and my friends were there and stuff. So I told them, but I didn't ring the police at that point. And then a day or two later, I got a bus from Ranelagh into town, and I was about to get another bus to where I worked.
Right.
And so I had to walk down the quays, and this man started to walk beside me and asked to get under my umbrella because it was raining. And I said no, actually, at first. But then he kept going on and on and kept saying things like, you know, I only want to do, you know, I only want to get under your umbrella, and I'm just going to this place, you know, trying to make me feel like I was the unreasonable one. But then I clocked that he was the same person who had grabbed my arm before.
Okay.
And so I started to, you know, take note of, like, you know, the colour of his hair and his eyes and his height and what he was wearing and things like that, because I knew that there was something wrong. And anyway, he wouldn't leave me, and he didn't stop where he said he was going to stop.
Okay.
And he continued walking along with me.
Oh, God.
And then I knew I was in trouble, because the place where I worked had a huge park around it, and people had been raped there before. I knew that. And so I knew I couldn't go there.
Okay.
But I got on the bus, and he got on the bus after me. And, you know, I sat down the back so that he couldn't sit behind me, but he came straight down and sat right next to me. And I was shouting out to people on the bus, but nobody would turn around. And so then I started panicking. He had opened his trousers and he had this bag with him with a towel in it and things like that you could see. And I should have gone to the bus driver and told him, but I panicked and I left. I got off at the stop. And he must have gotten off a few stops later and started to walk back towards my direction.
Mother of God.
Because I had rung, you know, my family, and I'd rung police and things. Oh, no, I hadn't rung the police. I'd rung a friend who said, yeah, she was going to meet me.
Yeah.
So I was walking to meet her. And when she arrived, he had started to walk back and he walked past. He had already started to shout at me at this point on the street, and I was trying to walk across the road and there were men walking around. Nobody would stop. I think everybody just assumed that these people know each other and, yeah, you know, and they were staying out of it. But when my friend arrived, then we went in to the city centre, back into the city centre.
Okay.
And when we were there, he walked past again. So we called.
My God.
And the police had him in a few minutes. Like, we just described what he was carrying, and he, okay, had a bag, and we described what was in it. And so then they took a statement for 3 hours. And they, you know, they have to just be really detailed,
yeah,
so that they don't miss anything. And so it went to court, and the police, you know, really wanted me to go and press charges because they said he had... he had assaulted other people during the week and that they were too afraid to go into court. And, you know, they wanted him to be caught for something. And so when he went in to court, I don't think he would have recognised my face, but because when you're in court, you know, he's sitting in the same room looking at you, yeah, all the way through this. He will never forget my face, you know. He did actually run after me about a year later. He didn't catch me because I ran into police, but he was out when he shouldn't have been because he was done for all... he was up for 11 things that day and he got charged for them all, but they're all run concurrently.
Yeah.
So really, they just go on a rampage. If he thinks he's going to get caught for one thing, he may as well do as many as he can fit in, you know, before he gets caught. He had 99 previous convictions that day when he was in court.
Oh,
and he had 198 previous convictions just a few years ago because we saw his name. Am I allowed to say his name?
Yeah, it was in the public domain. Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
Anthony Goodman. He was up for something else that he had just done, and it was in the paper. And so he's already done this extra 100 things, an extra 100 people had been affected by him. You know, I mean, the other people who were standing up who did have to, he pled guilty to mine, so I didn't have to stand up in court, but to other people, you know, they had to stand up in court and, you know, grown men shaking like a leaf trying to describe what he had done and breaking into their houses and things like that and stuff that he had done. So, you know, he's affected another 100 people since that day that I was in there.
Yeah.
And he just gets turned out again and again and again. You know, he's a maniac and he shouldn't be allowed out on the streets ever. But the system is just wrong. I mean, even then, for anybody to get a £5 fine, the choice was a £5 fine or a month in prison.
Because he was charged with exposure.
Yeah.
The incident on the bus.
Yeah. And so, he only got a month in prison for the exposure. But the two girls that he dragged down alleyways, he got nothing for that because they wouldn't go into court, even though, yeah, you know, even though they knew who it was, they had his description, you know, he was being charged for it. They just couldn't, or being brought into court for it, rather. They couldn't do anything because these people won't go into court, and rightly so, because I'm sure it would have been another ridiculous amount of time, ridiculous sentence that he would have gotten. And it would have run concurrently, so,
yeah,
you know.
And the last time I can see Goodman in court was in May 2019.
And yeah, I think it was around Christmas that we were talking about it, and my niece looked it up. So it was recent at that time. Yeah, so...
Yeah, he at that stage, Catherine, he had racked up 201 previous convictions.
Right, yeah. So, I mean, you know... Over
sexual assault,
more.
Indecency, arson, threats to kill, possession of firearms. This is Anthony Goodman.
Yeah.
He was subject to a sex offender's order, which he breached, and he could not travel on a bus without informing Gardaí.
Yeah,
he has
beaten up solicitors when he's seen them because they were, you know, involved in his cases and things like that.
His legal team, and this is what they're instructed to do, said his client instructed Anthony Goodman instructed him to apologise for his behaviour to the victims. Goodman said he'd no explanation for his actions and was at a loss why he does what he does. Where is, if you got a month for what he did to you, is he still in prison?
No, the day that he was in there, he got a month for mine, a year and a half for something else. And it was less than a year later that I was in the city centre and he saw me and he just dropped and ran after me. And so I, luckily at the time, could run fast enough and I outran him and ran straight up to police up on Connell Street. And so they were able to, they brought me into work instead of me having to get there any other way. But I mean... I was lucky I could run fast enough because he would have beaten me up again. Well, not again. He would have just beaten me up.
Okay. Catherine, this case I'm reading is October 2019 and it was adjourned for it was a probation report asked for adjourned till October the 11th, 2019. We'll try and find out during the break where Anthony Goodman is now. 201 previous convictions, all related to sexual assault, including, but as you say, Catherine, in your case, a horrific, horrific episode. What he was eventually charged with was that episode on the bus where he exposed himself and he got 1 month.
Mm-hmm.
And did he even serve a month in prison for that? I wonder.
Well, he served it at the same time as serving
the other, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
But, you know, you just things like that, like he's a stalker, you know. Mm-hmm. It's people like that. They get these pathetic sentences. They're the people who go on to rape people and kill people, you know. I think there's some huge percentage, like 70% of... stalkers then go on to much more serious crimes afterwards. Yeah. And I think that's where it needs to stop when it starts, you know, when it's...
Okay. Say with us, Catherine, joe@rt.ie.
Talk to Joe on 1850-715-815.
Mary Lynch, can I thank you for contacting us and raising these issues today and telling what happened to you in such one, the trauma, but two, in such a strong, courageous way, which will, as you heard from the other callers, will help others, I think. Sinead, thank you indeed, Sinead O'Leary.
Thanks, Joe.
And Sinead, thinking of Nicola today, Nicola Sweeney, God rest her. Nicola, what would have been in her 30s as well, around the same age as yourself, Sinead?
Yeah, and poor Nicola. You know, she's lost Nicola. So much, and so many people have lost so much because of her death, you know.
Yeah, God rest her, Nicola Sweeney. Catherine, thank you. Rachel, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
And thank you for contacting us and being prepared to, not that you don't relive it often enough, but to relive it publicly as well. Thank you so much.
Yeah. And, I just wish the DPP wouldn't be
judged and jury. Okay. We'll keep in touch, and I can see from the screen more women want to talk tomorrow on the same topic. The Rape Crisis Centre National 24-hour helpline is 1800 77 88 88. Lisa Marie Berry produced, and Ray Darcy's next.